Chapter 19, Return of the Southern Girl. Winter 2007. We drove through a nondescript neighborhood of Nashville, convinced we had our directions wrong. But we kept going, making one turn, then another, until we got to the address. Finally, we arrived at a corner lot surrounded by politely low stucco walls. Casey pressed the button at a low-key gate. A pleasant voice answered. "Good morning," Casey said. "We have an appointment with Dolly." The doors opened, and once we saw the building, it all made sense. There was a beautiful stucco and timber compound with red tiles, and at its center, there was a mission-style chapel right out of an Old West movie. It even had a little dome with a bell inside and a cross on top. This, of course, was Dolly Parton's office and rehearsal studio. Dolly and her kindness were the inspiration for me to come to Nashville and do a country album. As soon as Casey, my assistant Adrian, and I got settled into our rental house, one of Casey's first suggestions was that I call Dolly about the possibility of working together. I was afraid to call the number Dolly gave me after the Kennedy Center, so I made Casey call Dolly's manager, Danny Nozell, who was so lovely to her. Dolly called me right away and told me to come on in. She did her business work between 4 a.m. and 10 a.m. At 7 o'clock, we were her second meeting of the day. "Jess, are you shaking?" Casey asked me. "I'm just nervous is all," I said. As soon as we walked in, there she was yelling, "Hey!" She hugged me like we were reuniting after a long absence. There are people who embrace themselves so fully and live so authentically that you feel like you grew up with them. That's Dolly. She immediately started showing us around. The first stop was the chapel, a tiny little candlelit place that reminds you of those rooms tucked away in hospitals for prayer or quiet reflection. A place where anybody can come and feel at home, no matter what you believe in. She lit a candle for us and we all prayed together. Dolly put me at such ease. From there, she took my hand to lead me to her office. She sat behind a desk and Casey and I sat on pretty chairs. She put her hands together and looked at us. This was Dolly, the businesswoman. My heart swelled and I thought, this is how you build a career like hers. I talked about my goals for the album and she nodded. How I wanted to get back to singing from the heart, not to sing to sell records, but to make people feel. I was aware that I was a pop star coming to the country world, and I wanted to be respectful of that. I said that it would be an honor to write with her. "Yeah, I'd love to," she said. "But I'd like to send you some songs, too, that I think you might like." "Please," I said. "That would be amazing." I couldn't imagine being so talented that you had good songs that you hadn't gotten around to recording yet. But this was the woman who wrote Jolene and I Will Always Love You on the very same day, so it made sense. We went into her rehearsal space and she played us songs to get a feel for what I could do. Casey and I sat on a beat-up leather couch, luxuriating in her voice as she worked to get the songs right. When it was over, she gave me a bunch of demos to bring home and a big hug to keep with me. "I'm glad you're doing this," she said. "You are just so sweet and precious." I put my hand on my heart and teared up. When the door closed behind us, Casey and I looked at each other like we'd seen heaven. We were still shaking our heads when we got into the car. "It is so powerful for your idols to actually be who you thought they were," I said. "I can't believe she even met with me." "Of course she did, Jess," Casey said. "She loves you. People like Dolly Parton and Willie Nelson, they don't need a single thing from you. They're nice to you because they want to be." "I don't know why, though," I said. Casey looked at me a long time. "You're just a beat-up little bird, aren't you?" I nodded, and we drove back to our home away from home. That night, I was still flying from my time with Dolly. I didn't know what awaited me in Nashville. The tabloids were already sneering about me going country like it was a gimmick. But so far, everyone I had met in town had been kind to the new kid. The new kid. I had been that so many times when my family moved around that that's why I always sat with the lonely kids at lunch. I knew what it was like. Casey was right. Dolly and Willie were so kind because they didn't need anything material from anybody. They had it to give, and they'd sit with me. I was in Nashville at a time that it felt like if I raised my head to do anything in the public eye, someone had a pea shooter pointed at me. I had started dating a nice, normal guy, Tony Romo, the quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys around Thanksgiving, and even that was something for people to pick apart. Tony had seen my dad out a lot for about a year and had asked to be introduced. I always told my dad no, that I wasn't interested in athletes. "I'm a musician girl," I said. I believed that I could only date people who could relate to me because they were in the business, which I guess was my code for, I like emotional torture and fixing dark people. But I was watching ESPN one day at my parents' house, vegging on the couch, and they did a little interview with Tony. They asked him something like, "Who's your dream girl?" He answered without a beat, "Jessica Simpson." My dad laughed. "Told ya," he said. I thought about it for a minute. I liked his smile, and he seemed nice. What if I went off script and took a break from the dark and twisted? "Dad, call him," I said. "Tell him I'll see him." We met in secret and hit it off. A few days later, our families both watched him win a Thanksgiving Day home game, and then all had dinner together at our hotel restaurant. He sat next to me, and near the end of dinner, he started giving me puppy dog eyes, kind of leaning in like he was willing his lips to mine. "Are you seriously trying to have our first kiss in front of all these people?" I asked. "Maybe," he said. "Is this what real dating was? You simply went for it?" "We'll try it," I said to him and to me. We had a very chaste kiss, and it felt right. We went public quickly, which was also new for me. It was easy. He had no interest in drama. He said the Lord's Prayer every night before bed, a solid person who was the kind of guy that as a kid I imagined marrying. Because we were so public from the beginning, I was very proud when he invited me to the December 16th home game against the Philadelphia Eagles. It was a Sunday, and close to 100,000 of football's true believers all filed into the sacred church of Texas Stadium for the 4:15 game. The biggest thrill for me was that I got to bring my grandparents to sit with me. Nana and Papaw kept looking around, amazed at it all. The Cowboys had a 12-2 record, but had just had a lousy game the week prior. This was a chance for redemption. I proudly wore a pink version of Tony's jersey with his number 9 on the front, and there I was, cheering on my guy. And he proceeded to play the worst game of his career. It was bad from the start, and when the camera showed me huge up there on the screen, people found the reason. Why was this guy who just signed a 6-year, $67.5 million deal playing so poorly? It must be the blonde in the bleachers. "Send Jessica home," the chant began. "Send Jessica home." I couldn't quite make it out at first because it didn't occur to me that anybody would be giving me a role in how the Cowboys were playing. If I didn't hit a note at a concert, the audience wouldn't start screaming at Tony to get the heck out of the arena. My Nana and Papaw understood what was happening, some protective instinct kicking in as their beloved Cowboys booed their granddaughter. "Don't you listen to them," Nana said. I became mortified that this was happening in front of them. "Can I just tell you how much I knew about football? What it was like to be a coach's granddaughter growing up in Texas?" When there was 4 minutes and 19 seconds left in the game, Eagles running back Brian Westbrook got the ball and gained 24 yards before taking a knee just inside the 1-yard line. Everyone around me thought he was hurt. Did I? Nope. I knew what he was up to. Dallas had no more timeouts. If he actually scored the touchdown, we might get the ball back. And if we got the ball back, we might at least go out fighting. No, he wanted us to suffer. He took a knee 3 more times, letting the clock bleed out. It was insult added to injury, a humiliating 10-6 loss. And somehow, it was my fault. Jinx was the word everyone used. The media was cruel, and even Tony's teammate, Terrell Owens, talked about me to the press. "Right now, Jessica Simpson is not a fan favorite," he said, "in this locker room or in Texas Stadium." He also helpfully added that the last time Tony played close to this bad was the year before, when he had dated Carrie Underwood. T T.O. later apologized, and I held no grudge. But people had a new villain. They printed huge photos of me and made giant popsicle sticks of my head to taunt Tony at every single game. People dressed like me and acted stupid in the crowd. I didn't want that kind of power. I found myself having to assure people that I wanted the Cowboys to win. Perhaps sensing I was vulnerable, John inserted himself into the national conversation about me because why not? He posted an open letter to Cowboy fans on his blog, telling them, "That girl loves Texas more than you know. It's one of her most defining traits as a person, so please don't try and take that away from her." When Lauren, my publicist, called to tell me what he did, I threw the phone on the couch like it was the boogeyman. I figured Tony would get sick of people calling me a jinx and tell them to knock it off. He was constantly interviewed on the sidelines or at post-game press conferences. He could just look the camera in the eye and tell people that he was responsible for his performance and to leave his girlfriend alone. I waited. Unwelcome at my boyfriend's games, I was free to focus on my work in Nashville and see him when we both were off. It was what I needed. I got to work with the best people, including my producers, Brett James, who wrote Carrie Underwood's Jesus Take the Wheel, and John Shanks, who'd worked with Stevie Nicks, Bonnie Raitt, Kelly Clarkson, and a cool girl named Ashley Simpson. At my writing sessions, I would bring my notes from journals and even old emails from snuffed out flames. Like Dolly had, musicians and songwriters in Nashville accepted me, making me feel like I belonged. I loved hearing about their journeys, how they could just write a song and then bring it to the famous Bluebird Cafe to test it out for an audience. Artistically, that winter was a magical time for me, but it was extremely taxing emotionally. It helped that I was in a good relationship with Tony, despite the apparent football jinx, which allowed me to write happy songs like Come On Over and You're My Sunday. But there was also a reckoning with my weaknesses and the pain I'd experienced. The daily writing sessions were like therapy, tearful and raw. Doing songwriting, I felt naked in front of fluorescent lights. Adrian and Casey would come and get me, and I'd get in the car all talked out. At the house, I wouldn't even take off my heavy ski jacket. I marched into the kitchen, pulled down a bottle, usually Kettle One, and sat at a little desk. Night after night, I sat at my laptop, going down Google rabbit holes or Skyping with Tony. I kept the bottle next to me, drinking until I'd take the edge off all those bubbling emotions and kept going until I couldn't even feel the smoothness of simple thought. I was just a body needing to rest until my brain kicked in again for the next writing session. Casey had never seen me like this, and Adrian didn't want to play nursemaid. It was scary. They started marking the liquor bottles to keep track of my drinking. This went on for some time, until Adrian confronted me. I closed the door on her, and later I let her think I was too drunk to remember that she said I needed to stop drinking so much. But I remembered. It was only recently, when we talked about that time in Nashville, that I told her I could recall everything she had said. A lot of people, even when they're out of control, have an ability to control others. Your anxiety and your addiction team up like viruses that need to grow in the host body. You train other people to work around them to keep their peace. I told myself that this was an extreme time, and sure enough, once I was done songwriting, I didn't need that crutch of alcohol so much. There was something about getting close to all that truth that my mind couldn't handle. It was another early warning sign of what would come, but again, I ignored it. By the time I got to the recording sessions, I had worked through so much that it was the most comfortable I'd ever felt singing in the studio. I did 3 songs the very first day, and when we did the last cut, I thanked myself for walking through the fear. I co-wrote all but 3 of the songs on the album and decided on Dolly's song Late in the Game. It was called Do You Know, and I loved it so much I wanted it to be the title of the whole album. It was one of the last I recorded and sent the finished version over to get her blessing. I wasn't about to mess up a Dolly song. She loved it so much she asked if I would be interested in doing it as a duet. I think our voices would sound good together. Yes, was my answer. If I did nothing else with my career, Dolly Parton wanted to sing with me. One of the many benefits of the Jessica Simpson collection taking off was that I could make the music I wanted. I no longer needed a label to dictate my every move. I could offer it to people, and if it provided a soundtrack to one of their decisions or put words to something they couldn't quite get a hold of, that's why I did it. I did it for me, and I did it for them. When Do You Know came out in September, it hit number one on Billboard's country chart. I went just about everywhere to promote the album, and it was nice to be able to be less guarded with the press. I had a simple life with a nice guy, and if people asked about my marriage or John, I could easily sidestep the questions. I didn't have to do much to promote Major Movie Star, which went almost straight to DVD as Private Valentine. Before it came out, I held a special screening of the film and a concert for troops stationed at Camp Buring, an army base in the northwestern desert of Kuwait. It was about 25 miles from the Iraqi border, a stopping point for many troops on the way to their deployment, a threshold between their life at home and a life at war in the desert. I embraced my fear this time and made it less about my experience and more about understanding what these men and women were facing. That night I slept in the barracks with my little angel figurine to watch me. "See, Jess," I said aloud to myself, "you're growing up." In November, Tony bought a house near Texas Stadium, so I began to spend much more time there when I wasn't working. I would stay with him for a few days and then go back out on the road for an event or to work on the Jessica Simpson collection. When I started talking about Dallas as my home base, my friends didn't understand it, but I was trying out normal life with a truly committed relationship. If John texted or emailed, I would hold up my phone and tell Tony immediately. He knew the hold John had over me, and it was like telling your sponsor when you're triggered. He'd seen how I'd reacted when John randomly showed up at my parents' Halloween party in Encino. I had no idea he was coming and was shocked. I had gone full out dressed as Chewbacca from Star Wars, fur all over my face. I was having a good time, safe with my family. And then there he was. My heart was in my chest and I turned around, trying to blend into the crowd. A 5'3" girl dressed as Chewbacca. Not how you would want to run into your ex with your current boyfriend standing right there. John routinely used his friendship with Ashley's then-husband, Pete Wentz, from Fall Out Boy, as an excuse to stay in the Simpson family orbit. My parents knew what he had done to me, but John was always so charming. They also knew I still loved John, and before I got married to Tony, I needed to either have closure or go back at it again. Tony wouldn't come out and admit it, but I know he worried I would leave him. One of the few parameters he put on the relationship was actually a big one. He didn't want me to do any movies that required an on-camera kiss, which basically ruled out any romantic comedy, the type of movie for which I was most likely to be cast. I get it, some people can't handle another person making out with their girlfriend, even for work, but there were only so many plucky fish-out-of-water stories with no male romantic leads. I think it was more about how he would be perceived than the love scene actually happening. What would people think of him for allowing that to happen? He was less vocal about his real fear that, given my past and my proven ability to fall in love on a film set, I would do it again. I didn't have a good defense for that, I'll admit. "Your Honor, the prosecution would like to invite the following actors to the stand." But I would have never done that to Tony. When my friends came to Dallas to visit, I would get them rooms at the Four Seasons or Hotel Zaza. They wondered why they couldn't stay at Tony's since his home had 6 bedrooms. But I was basically living at a frat house. He had his high school buddies there, always on the couch eating pizza. I remember the moment I realized they were all playing the Madden NFL video game and Tony was playing himself. It was just so bizarre. Decorating was also not his thing, and I wasn't interested in overstepping and didn't have time to anyway. For a long time, he had garbage bags up on the windows instead of blinds. It wasn't that he was cheap. It never occurred to him to bother. He would have $350,000 checks as bookmarks next to the toilet, leaving them uncashed. But I liked the easiness of Dallas, where I rarely saw paparazzi. I spent a lot of time with my old Sunday school teacher, Carol Vanderslice. She was as non-judgmental as she was back before all the fame, and we fell back into the rhythm of me being able to confide concerns and hear back solid advice founded in a practical faith. She was one of the only people who knew how hurt I was that Tony refused to stick up for me. I had taken to wearing a blue jersey on game days and told everyone it was that pink jersey that was cursed, not me. Things started to get better. But still, when I went to those games, I would be so tense and twisted up from watching football in the box that the next day I would be sore. In so many ways, we were supportive of each other, and it turned out that it was easier when you didn't do the same thing. He loved my music, and when we'd go out on the boat I bought him, he would play my album so loud you could hear it across the lake. He'd sing along at the top of his lungs. If he had the guys from the team over, he would put on my music, and I would jokingly hide as he rewound to certain parts. He'd say to them, "Did you hear how long she held that note?" This was the kind of encouragement I was getting from the country community. I was really touched when Rascal Flatts asked me to take over for Taylor Swift as the opening act on the 20-city leg of their Bob That Head tour, starting in mid-January 2009. Joining them would be such a big deal for me. It was set to start just before I had a gig at a country radio festival on January 25th in South Florida. Alan Jackson would be there, along with Jason Aldean and Little Big Town. Great exposure for me with the country audience. It was an annual event, I was told. Something about a chili cook-off.